From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a dance class where 5-year-old Veronica was putting on ballet shoes for the first time. Before the class was created, Veronica, who uses a wheelchair, told her family that she wanted to be a dancer, but she didn't think she could. She told them that no one wanted her. That's when her family called a physical therapist and a dance instructor named Joanne. When they told her what Veronica said, Joanne didn't waste any time. She founded an organization called Dancing Dreams, a dance class and performance opportunity for kids with physical disabilities. Veronica was one of the first members and continues to dance there today. She's now 16. Her story is just one of those featured in the documentary Perfectly Normal for Me, which follows 4 kids and their families as they prepare for a spring recital with Dancing Dreams. The film will be screened tonight at the Little Theater and will preview at this hour as part of our Dialogue on Disabilities Week here at WXXI. Throughout the week, we'll have conversations about how to create more inclusive communities and what inclusion really means. This hour, we're focusing on recreation activities for kids with special needs. And there's so much here. How parents can help find a balance between independence and support that their children need. We'll also discuss, as we said, not only what true inclusion looks like, but how we navigate even how kids are feeling when they are saying things like Jake, one of the kids in the film, who just said, "I just want to be a normal kid. That's my lifetime goal." Or Kathleen, one of the dance graduates, who said, "Most people don't think of our bodies as graceful and beautiful." That's so hard to hear from kids, but we're all working on it. That's part of the goal, is having these conversations and making change and progress. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. Erin Davis is a special education autism teacher at CP Rochester's Augustin Children's Center. Erin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Mike Riddell. He's an education coordinator and camp director at Epilepsy Prelude, Inc. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And with us is Rachel Rosner, director of education and support services at Autism Up and a parent of 2 children with autism. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
Tonight, Perfectly Normal for Me is screening at the Little Theater. It's only about an hour long, 6 p.m. 6 p.m., and it is free. So I can't tell you enough. These kind of conversations are so important. I think what you'll do is you'll see the film at 6 o'clock. It's about an hour long. Again, it's free at the Little. And then there's a discussion afterwards with the director via Skype. You're going to have a panel discussion. The audience can participate. You're going to see parts of the film, and there's parts of you that will, I think you may cry. I think you're going to feel for these kids. You're going to see really inspirational moments, but you're also maybe going to be frustrated at times, or you might disagree with certain approaches. There's not any sort of one perfect approach here, but these events are so important as part of Dialogue on Disability Week here. So Perfectly Normal for Me tonight, 6 p.m. at the Little. And Erin, as we talk about how what we do for all the kids in our community, what did you make of the film? How did you feel about it?
It made me a little sad and frustrated at some points, seeing these young kids have such almost a negative feeling about themselves, and kind of wondering where that comes from and how to change it, and being able to start it at such a young age in my preschool setting, kind of changing the way these kids and other kids will think about themselves in the future.
Okay. Mike, what did you think?
I think it starts with confidence and self-esteem. And if they don't get that from home or the people closest to them as they're getting, you know, as they grow older, they're not going to accomplish their goals, you know, and so they need to have that I can do it no matter what, and portray that to people in the community so that they can do whatever they want to do.
Okay. Rachel?
I thought it was a really honest look at the way family dynamics can work in a family that has a child with a disability. I think some of the pieces were, as you said, difficult to watch. I felt myself cringing and saying, no. But I think that we can only know what we know about our own families and our own experiences, and you know, trying to spread information is the reason why we're here.
Let's listen to some of what the kids themselves had to say. And this is a clip from Veronica. So we mentioned 15-year-old Veronica. Really, one of the most compelling moments of the film was when she said, "I want to be a dancer, but I can't because nobody wants me." Her family contacted Joanne after hearing this. And so you get Dancing Dreams as a result. Veronica starts attending the program when she was 5 years old. Let's listen to what she had to say then.
I think it's kind of sad that I had the thought in my head,
that nobody wanted me, and that was the reason I couldn't be or do something that I wanted. No person should ever think that, especially a five-year-old. Because when you're five, you think you can jump off the bed in a homemade cape you made and fly. Even when your parents tell you you can't, you're still going to try and do it.
It's so true. Let's go around the table. What did you think of that moment when she's saying no five-year-old should be thinking that?
Absolutely. I think she's quite amazing. From that five-year-old girl, look what she has turned into. Kudos to the professionals and to her family for taking the bull by the horns, if you will, and seeing a need for their own daughter and turning it into something that can benefit the community, all the while teaching her the things she needs to know about herself and advocating for herself.
Mike?
Innate intelligence. Kids have they're very smart. And even though they can, they're told one thing, they know, that their goals, their aspirations are limitless. And they just have to have that opportunity to be able to do that. And I don't think that it took a while in this case for that to happen. But like we said, thanks to the professionals, we were able to get in there and help out.
Mm. What did you think?
You almost wonder, where does that five-year-old in everybody go? Because you have that belief in yourself when you're younger. And where do children lose it along the way? And is there a way where we can keep that five-year-old? I would still love to have some of that belief that I could jump off my bed and fly with a cape. So where do we lose that along the way?
I think there's some layers to this idea that a five-year-old is thinking, nobody wanted me or nobody wants me. That's not necessary, and you may be thinking bullying. We're going to get to that in a second, but that's not even necessarily the case. I think it's a little bit of how society is structured, how we teach families, we teach kids what the word normal means, and I wonder if it's not just bullying, if we're sort of limiting in ways that even if we don't intend it. What do you think?
I think it definitely could be unintentional. We definitely say that these are your typical peers in the classroom. But why are they the people you should be learning from when they can be learning just as much from their non-typical peers? So I think it's very much starts at home and with us professionals on how we decide to word it to these small minds that don't know any difference at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mike?
I think that we have to take a look at where we were at one point 50, 60 years ago and where we are now. And things have changed dramatically. And I think a lot of people still have that same mindset, that old school mindset of how we approach people with disabilities. It should be approaching people, period, not whether you have a disability, whether you are green or yellow or purple, whether you're a person and what you can do. I think that back in the day, when I say back in the day, a long time ago, people with disabilities were institutionalized and left to basically left to die, and that is so far from the truth nowadays. And people just have to realize that every individual is just that, an individual, and they have a lot to contribute.
And I think when you look at the progress society has made from literally institutionalizing to where we are, it may be there may be a danger of getting complacent and not recognizing how is it that a five-year-old, Rachel, is saying, nobody wants me. How do you think we get that where a five-year-old, and this is probably a decade ago, whatever the case is saying, well, I'm five, but nobody wants me. We can only sort of guess about certain things, but how does that happen?
I think part of it is that there's a lack of example of people who've gone before. What you were saying before, Mike, about where we were 50 years ago, what about where we were 20 years ago? Maybe a little more from when I was in high school, but there was no one when I was growing up going to, I'm not even 50 years old yet. And there were none of those kids in school with me growing up. There's no very few examples for the younger kids to look to right now. And there are still relatively few opportunities. The opportunity that's talked about in the film with the dance class for people with physical disabilities, the things that agencies in town are doing are spectacular and wonderful and a really terrific starting point. But I think that I would generalize and say that society-wide, most of the time, that's where those opportunities end. What we really want is a truly inclusive environment, and that does not mean a separate dance class over there for those kids with physical disabilities.
All right. Well, so Rachel went there. So let's talk about this. And by the way, before the hour's up here, you know, CP Rochester, Epilepsy Prelude, Autism Up, these are organizations that do so much, and they're going to tell you about what they're doing and how they view these issues of inclusion, what it means to their organizations, because that's important. And Rachel, here you are saying, that dance class over there. I don't hear you criticizing the intent and the love of the people who created this, because obviously the results in some cases have been amazing. But is it a symptom of a society that still separates too much? How do you view the question of inclusion?
I think that a dance class like that is fantastic, serves a need, fills a void. But the fact that there's no next step, I don't remember the name of the young girl in the film who said, I don't know what I'm going to do when this is done. You know, there's going to be a void in her life. There's no plan in place for her to be able to take her love of dance and do something else with it. There's no way for her to take what she's learned and move forward. It's like an encapsulated experience that was super cool and really wonderful, but there's no way to build on that for her as an individual person, but for programs and opportunities like that don't exist. I would have loved for the helpers in the class to be dancing alongside them.
Okay. Mike, what do you think?
I totally agree, and the different agencies around town, we have programs for individuals who have certain types of disabilities, and especially I can speak for our own Epilepsy Prelude. We have these teen weekends or these camps. Okay, they're for those individuals who have the disorder of epilepsy, but a lot of the stuff that they learn at these programs and camps and whatever take them and force them almost to go to the next level, and so that they can be as independent and accomplish the goals. I keep saying accomplish the goals, but you know, get to where they want to be, not where someone else wants them to be.
Yeah, I think that's a huge issue. This question of, is it a one-off experience that, well, it's over now, versus we're changing your life. Inclusion means an ongoing experience. How do you view it?
I think the biggest question we get a lot from the parents is, where do I go to find these inclusive mm-hmm. activities for my kids? And it is often just like, oh, well, you can go here and they have this dance class. But it's not, how do I continue that throughout just this one little moment? How do I get their whole life to be an inclusive environment?
All right. Well, listeners, again, you've got the chance to see the film that has prompted this discussion as part of our Dialogue on Disability Week here. The event is Perfectly Normal for Me, screening tonight at 6 p.m. at the Little. It's free, and then a Q&A to follow with the director, Catherine Tambini. And by the way, a couple of listeners have already asked if the film has captions tonight. It does. And there will be an interpreter for the Q&A with the director after the screening. So the answer is yes and yes to those questions. I want to listen to another cut from this. This is from, I think this is Jake. Let me pull up. Yeah, this is Jake. So Jake is a young guy. I'm trying to remember, Megan Mack. 8-10 years old. Is it something like that, if I'm remembering? So you see Jake, for example, on the playground. And here he is. He's trying to climb. He wants to do all the things that the kids are doing on the playground. You know, his mom's nervous for him. She's worried about him hurting himself. She's worried about him falling. Jake's in second grade, and he's trying to be a kid. But, he's navigating this world. So Jake and his mom addressed how he has been bullied. And so this is Jake and his mom, Laura, for example, and just in the challenges they face. This is one of the many talking about bullying.
I have all these disabilities, so some people make fun of me. Some of my friends, you know, they're my friends. Sometimes they make fun of me. When I don't have any of the gadgets on, they're kind. But when I have the gadgets on, mean.
As far as bullying and all that, just recently, there was an incident at school. He was in gym, and they were having a race, and he came in last. And one of his own friends said, Jake, you're an idiot for not winning, and you shouldn't really be running in this race because you're not very good at it. So that did have an effect on him. And, you know, he cried while he told me the story. He's tired of everyone telling him what to do. He's tired of the therapies. He's tired of wearing his braces. He just wants to be like everybody else. And his goal for the third grade is not to use a walker at all.
Well, let me read a separate quote from Jake before we turn to our panel. At one point in the film, Jake says, "I just want to be a normal kid. That's my lifetime goal. Everyone at my school doesn't wear a helmet, and I just feel like I'm out of the fun when I wear a helmet." End quote. That is hard, hard to hear. And, but you also have a time on the playground, Rachel, where his mom is wants him to wear a helmet. She's nervous. He's trying to climb. He's doing it, but she's nervous for him. How did you kind of navigate your own emotions watching that as a mom, as someone who works in this community? How did you feel watching that story?
I felt incredibly conflicted. I felt so sad for him that he wanted so much to climb and run and play, and that his own mom was not allowing him to have those experiences. I tried to remind myself that I don't know what I don't know about their particular situation. I don't know what could happen to him if he falls on the playground, and what the repercussions of that could be. But listening to him, I would hope that if his mom could rewind that moment, instead of saying no, 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 she would try to find a different way for him to participate. Instead of continuing to close the door, to find ways for the door to open for him in a way that would be safe and fun. In this particular case, it didn't seem like both of those things went together. And he just wanted so much to be with the other kids his age playing basketball. And I can't imagine how hard it was for him to even just be on the playground and not be able to participate.
All right, so there's so much there. Let's take one little thread of this. And so I'm the parent of a kid who's in March going to be 7, and he does not have a disability, but any parent can relate to when the kid, especially when the kid's 2, 3, 4, but as they get older, they want to do everything. And there were times I remember when I found myself often saying, like, nope, 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 nope. And I actually one day, like, said to myself, look for ways to say yes today. I feel like I'm telling him no a lot, you know, and how can I say yes? Well, here's a mom who, you know, Rachel, you're thinking about the mom, you know, Jake's mom in this film. And I think you're hearing her feel that worry, and she's finding herself saying no a lot, and you're just kind of gently encouraging, how can we say yes more? As a mother yourself of 2 children with autism, did you have to look for ways to say, look, I want to say yes. Let's find a way to say yes to this.
Absolutely. I do that every day. I have to remind myself, I don't have neurotypical kids, but I am an educator in my professional life. And I have to remind myself that every child deserves the right to take risks in their life. That's how children learn. That's why we want them to climb on the playground and jump off the swings and eat the sand in the sandbox and all of those things that we know are completely disgusting. But it's worth the risk for our kids to learn those skills. As the parent of a child with a disability, the risk-taking is loaded with all kinds of other things. So finding the ways to say yes, finding the strength to let them go ahead is a really important thing, not just for the child, but for the parents as well.
And sometimes I imagine it's saying, okay, the child wants to do X, may not be realistic, but how do I find a way to say yes and maybe even if I have to approach it in a different way? I mean, it just feels, or maybe not. Sometimes it's just kind of letting go of fear at times. I guess there's always a balance to be to be struck there.
Mm-hmm. And I think especially as kids get older, the risks are different. The challenges are different. The safety aspect can be different. My son is about to turn 21, which is terrifying for many reasons. But part of what he wants to do, as he should be doing, is to be independent. I should not be carpooling him around at the age of 21 to the places where he wants to go. But he does have autism and he doesn't drive. So how do I balance that? What can I find for him as his parent that allows him the independence to navigate the world he wants to participate in without me. That particular piece has been really hard, but he's a great kid, not kid anymore, and has done a wonderful job of showing us the skills that he does have. He has the desire, you find the way. And once you can get past that anxiety and know that he can do it, it's so much more gratifying to see the risk being taken.
And Mike, it feels like kind of this moment is like a sort of a microcosm of society as a whole. Again, going back to your point about, well, why did we literally institutionalize? We thought nothing was really capable, that was all that there was. So we have been saying no collectively to children and then adults with disabilities for decades now. But then from the parenting perspective, that anxiety about saying yes, how do you view it as a camp director? How do you view it as someone who kind of lives in that world too?
Well, if anybody knows me, they know that I love talking about my camp. We have a camp for kids with epilepsy, and it's a chance for these kids to break out of their shell and to come, and it's a 1,000-acre camp. There's trails, there's climbing walls, and there's swimming pools, and there's canoes that they do. They have the supervision levels to be able to do that kind of stuff. So when they come back from camp, and ironically enough, camp is in August, so they start school in September, they have that ability to have that confidence to do things that they may not have tried before or been able to do before, because they're just given that opportunity. And once they're given that opportunity, then they can run to the stars with it.
How do parents feel? How often are you having conversations with parents saying, hey, we can say yes to this. This can happen.
So a lot of times when the parent calls me to get information about our summer camp, the kids are all in. They want to go and they want to do all this kind of stuff. It takes a while to convince the parents that they're going to come to this camp. They're going to be safe. We have medical staff. We have neurologists. We have a lot of the camp counselors that are at the camp are former campers, you know, and they come back to volunteer their time to give those opportunities. So it does take the parents a little while, but once they get a glimpse of what their child is able to do when they come back, they're sold. You know, we have some campers that have been coming for years and years and years because their self-esteem, their confidence just goes through the roof when they are just given the opportunity.
Erin, how do you view about the challenge of saying yes?
I think as a parent and as a teacher, I want to protect those children, and sometimes that's your own fear and anxiety. You don't want to ever see a child sad or rejected for trying. So we have to think, like, how can we help this child who maybe wants to go play with these friends but doesn't have words? They're nonverbal. So we teach the typical kids how to respond to them using a textbook. And then we have to deal with the not so pretty stuff. If they get rejected and that kid's sad about that, taking away my own fear and anxiety of how am I going to help them learn and how am I going to help both students grow from that situation. So sometimes you have to let go of that fear that might hurt that child's feelings. They might not get the answer they want. So I feel like sometimes it's the adults and us trying to protect them when we really have to help them navigate the world, whether it's going to be a positive outcome or not the answer they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many sort of universal lessons with this. Anybody who is sort of mentoring a colleague who's younger and you say, well, I don't want them to make the same mistakes. That's good, but what if they never make a mistake? How do you learn if you don't make mistakes? What if you never trip? In a job, in school, in life. That is not endorsing injury or, you know, getting hurt all the time. But, you know, as a parent myself, you're always worried, well, what if he trips and falls? Well, he's probably going to get up. It's going to be okay. But the separate part of this, though, is, okay, if we say yes, then what happens if bullying happens? What happens? Because Jake experienced it, and his mother, Laura, was talking about that and how devastating that can be. How often do you see bullying? What do you do about bullying?
Surprisingly enough, we don't see it very often in our classrooms. We see a lot more of that curiosity. So they don't necessarily mean to be bullying or saying something mean. They're just asking questions. And I think if we start at that level and answer those questions honestly, like, you know, why doesn't my friend talk? Why are they using these pictures to ask me for something? And just explaining, well, they don't have words right now, so they're going to use this to tell you how they're feeling. Or, you know, so-and-so's in a wheelchair. Why are they using that? Well, that's how they walk around. And we even call their communication systems their words. We tell the kids those are so-and-so's words. They're their mouth. They're their way of communicating. So I think at the younger age, it's just not necessarily knowing any better and answering the questions honestly so that they have a good, solid understanding of their peers who might be different, and then moving from there so they don't ever feel embarrassed to ask the honest questions.
Okay. Mike?
I think another piece of it is getting that confidence to be able to talk about it. It's not a secret that your child has a disability. So you want to kind of advocate, you know, not only the parent, but the child too can advocate for themselves. And if they have the disability from a very young age, they grow up with it. They know it so that their friends are aware of it, and they can just include them just like any other child in the classroom or in the camp or out in the community. So if they just kind of epilepsy is also has been known as the silent disorders. You couldn't tell if someone has epilepsy by just looking at them. But you know, when they have a seizure, they have to let people know what to do. You know, it's basic seizure first aid steps. And they're more, if you explain it more and more and more, the more comfortable you are explaining it. And it's almost not a big deal anymore if you can articulate that to people who don't know.
Okay. Rachel, how do you feel about bullying? How often have you encountered it sort of from a parent perspective? What do you do about it?
Well, like I said, my son is almost 21. And in his school career, there was one large sort of outward, very obvious incident that impacted him greatly. He was very aware of what was going on and completely terrified. But I think he was very lucky that he was included in the general education class all through elementary school with the support that he needed. So he was constantly surrounded by what we call typical peers. And he was embraced by them because he had been with them since day one. They all knew and loved each other and went to each other's birthday parties, all of that kind of thing. It did become apparent when he was a little older that that wasn't the right setting anymore, and he did go into a little bit more of a restricted setting. And I think it was, I guess, more about being separated. And so those kids in the general education classroom not knowing what that's about, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. understanding what that's for. Why is he going to a different school? Why is he going in a different classroom? You know, I don't understand what that is. I think for my daughter, it manifests itself a little bit differently. She's in public high school with everybody else, some general education classes, some special ed classes, and she is doing her best. And some of the things she does are not what typical kids would expect. And sometimes they don't respond to that in the nicest of ways. I think it stems from the same thing that was being talked about before, just a lack of knowledge. But I do take heart that the kids these days are much more tolerant and understanding because they've gone to school with our kids. I know in my heart that when my kids grow up and have a job and a life and a family, that they're going to be working alongside peers who have been with them since they were little. That's not the case for people who are adults now. And I'm definitely heartened by that and thankful for the laws that are in place that allow that to happen.
I'm late for break, so one more point with you on this. And here's a story that I know our listeners, the everyday listeners, of which we know there's lots of them, have maybe heard raised before, but this comes to mind so strongly for me on this. So I was a camp counselor back in the 1990s in another lifetime. And when I started out as a junior counselor, and for the decade prior, camp had 6 weeks of what they called regular camp, and then they had 2 weeks of Rotary camp, sponsored by Rotary. It was kids with various disabilities for 2 weeks. And then after a lot of conversations, by the time I was a senior counselor and a director, give credit to John O'Brien, the director of the camp down there, it's on Chautauqua Lake, who said, that's it. We're not doing separated weeks anymore. We're doing integrated camp every week of the whole summer, all the time. And that's always been the case now. So What I noticed as a counselor was, you know, we had kids with Down syndrome, neuroatypicity, kids who needed a wheelchair, kids who suffered from seizures, all kinds of different challenges. And yes, when boys are 10, 11, 12, 13, you know, I mean, boy, I don't know how anybody ever dealt with me. That's hard. You know, even, you know, sort of neurotypical boys at that age. It's a hard age. There's some immaturity. There's different emotional development. And those the first hours of that camp, that first night, maybe the first day, occasionally you'd hear a little snickering or a little making fun. And we were very direct about that. We nipped that. But by day three, and certainly by the end of the week, those kids were like arms linked friends and defending against anybody who would mock. They went from, I don't really know, I've never really been around a child who has X, Y, and Z, you know, maybe laughing at it, to going, oh, that's just my friend Steve, and don't you dare make fun of the fact that he uses a walker. And it was amazing to see. And that makes me, because when I hear you say, well, our kids these days are better at it because it's more integrated, that's the first thing I think of. It changed everything for those kids, but it didn't happen immediately because they hadn't had the experience. So I guess just for me, it's just an endorsement on integrating wherever you can. How do you feel about that?
Absolutely. I think since I think it was 1980, the schools have been integrated in that way, for lack of a better word, at the moment. And I think it has started to make a huge difference. I think there's still a long way to go. The system is far from perfect. But the idea, just the mere idea and fact that everybody knows that these folks are, that people with disabilities exist in the world, and that they're your next door neighbor and your coworker and your teammate and your classmate, is a huge thing. So I think we're pretty good with the awareness piece. And now I'd like to see society shifting to the true inclusion and integration for people with disabilities.
Okay. Mike, Aaron, you think kids these days are ready for it? They're doing better than maybe the previous generations?
Oh, I love kids are awesome. They can do some great things, disability or not. So, but going back to when you were saying you were a camp counselor, I remember back when I was also a camp counselor a long, long time ago, and we had handicap weekends where these individuals, adults and children alike, would come and utilize the facility. And I remember having a thought process, why can't we just have regular camp without having this special weekend and having those individuals come? So I'm really glad that we're moving in the direction and almost there.
Yeah, I think we did too at the camp I worked at. There were fall weekends, things like that, which let me also say, it's easy to sort of speak from the mountaintop and look down on it. That was a big deal at the time in probably the 80s and the 90s when that became a thing, because there was no camp weekends. And some camps, there were no weeks at all for children with various disabilities to have. So all of it out of good intention. But you start to see the impact of separating versus allowing everyone to live together. And the difference to me was clear. So what do you think, Aaron?
I think I agree. We're all aware now. I think awareness is a big thing that's happened. And so now that we're aware, what are the next steps? How are we going to become inclusive now that you're aware of everything and all the differences in everyone?
All right. So the Dialogue on Disability continues all week on WXXI. And part of that is the event tonight, 6 p.m. at the Little Theater. The screening is free. The film is Perfectly Normal for Me. It's about an hour long, a documentary film, and the director, Catherine Tambini, is going to join via Skype in a discussion afterward. You can join the conversation. Seats are first come, first served tonight, starting at 6 p.m. At the other side of this break, the word normal, perfectly normal for me. Well, Jake in the film says, I just want to be a normal kid. And I know our guests, number one, like anybody, hurt for Jake when you hear that. But they also have something to say about just that word and how it gets into kids' minds and what it means. And I think there's a lot there. So we're going to hit that when we come back here with Mike Riddell, Education Coordinator and Camp Director at Epilepsy Prelid, Inc., Aaron Davis, a Special Education Autism Teacher at CP Rochester's Augustine Children's Center, and Rachel Rausner, Director of Education and Support Services at Autism Up. Let's get that break and come right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, you might have heard headlines about hospital pricing, that pretty soon we're going to be able to know what procedures and medicine is going to cost. But is that realistic? Can they really tell you everything in advance? We talk about what will and won't change when it comes to medical pricing. Then in our second hour, the Dialogue on Disability looks at early intervention. It's been a big debate locally. We examine it on Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's grab a phone call from Richard in Brighton, who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, thank you. I was struck by the comment early in the discussion about a handicapped person who, after receiving training and education, was at wit's end as to what to be able to do with it. So I want to describe a situation that, to my way of thinking, is a solution to that, and that involves my youngest brother. He was a he went to MIT to study mechanical engineering, and at MIT, enterprises and people from all over the world send in problems that the faculty puts up on a board, lists there, and a student can tackle the problem, any one of these, for a thesis paper or whatever it is. And my brother was looking at this list, and he saw this interesting problem posed by the Massachusetts Institute for the Blind, and it was to help a person build a workstation that would enable a person with minimal vision in one eye to function as a customer service person. And my brother thought he'd take that on. So in the course of it, he was working with physicians he solved the problem. And one thing led to another. He loved the job, and it piqued his creativity. But the point of it all was that the employer in this case, the telephone company, said, you know, if we can find somebody to do a little technical work, technological development, we can afford to underwrite a project that would enable someone who's handicapped to work for the telephone company. And by the same token, the patient in this case, most of my brother's patients over the years that he did this, were brilliant. They had brilliant minds. Maybe they had handicapped bodies, but they certainly were capable. And he went on doing these projects. It was fascinating.
All right, Richard, thank you for that. And I appreciate the sentiment and the phone call. I'll ask our guests thoughts on that. What do you think, Rachel?
I think it's a terrific example of one of the things that I try to explain to parents when they're trying to solve a problem on behalf of their child. The most important question you can ask is why? Why is this happening? Why is this a problem? And to really dig down deep to find out really what's happening, because things are not always as they appear on the surface. But the opposite side of that coin is what we were talking about before. Why not? Once you identify what's really going on, let's make the change. Let's make the shift, the accommodation. Let's build something, change something, fix something to make it possible.
Okay, Mike?
Sometimes all it takes is to fix something is just knowledge. We go out and educate teachers in school and community members on how to deal with a disability if and when they need to. And if all they need is that knowledge, and a lot of times people can solve those issues on their own without even realizing it.
Okay, Erin?
I think sometimes it's just looking at the why, like Rachel's. You don't even know what the problem is, and once you've identified it, sometimes it's such a small tweak that you don't even realize is there. And so just looking at it and then thinking, why and how can I make this possible? And just trying. You might fail, but in the end, you also might have a great outcome.
One question based on this call, so we can all sort of think about this, and I don't know if the word, do we say handicapped anymore? That's not it, no. Okay, so Richard certainly isn't using that term in a bad spirit, and it's language I think is somewhat outdated. So again, Richard, I don't bring that up at all to sort of condemn. I mean, I think your heart's in a very, very good place. But I think the language probably matters. So I've learned that as well in various places. When you speak for 500 hours extemporaneously on the air a year, you say a lot of things that you would like to reel back in, or when you can't reel them back in, you learn from them. So let's talk a little bit about language. In this film, Jake says, "I just want to be a normal kid. That's my lifetime goal." First of all, that's just, oh, God, this second grade child. What he's saying by that is, I am not normal. That's essentially what it means. He views himself as not normal, and his friends at school are normal, and he wants to be normal like them. I imagine that's not the word we would want him to think of himself as, right? What do you think?
No. I definitely, first of all, normal is such like a relative term. Like, what is normal and how did he decide that what his friends acted like or how they did something is normal and that the way he's doing it is not. We definitely don't use that term, and we don't say to like our kids like, oh, you're the normal kids in class and you're, you know, these are your friends. And how does someone so young just come up with that idea that what the way they're doing something isn't normal?
Mike?
In the years that I've been working in the human service field, we've taken these terms or words, you know, and attached them to an individual. You know, we talk about, you don't talk to, you don't say someone who has epilepsy is an epileptic or you know, we've gone through, I could tell, give you many, many examples of what we refer to people who have disabilities. How about a person? How about an individual? You know, it's very simple, you know, that person, or rather than that person with a disability.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Rachel?
For Jake and for so many of our kids that have disabilities, I would work to expand his language, the vocabulary that he uses to talk about himself and the things that are challenging to him. It's like when kids are in preschool, we teach them happy, mad, sad. Those are all your emotions. Well, that's not exactly true. There's lots and lots more than that. But we put those into those general categories and kind of stop there. Instead, I would take the focus away from the word normal and talk about his strengths, talk about the things he has in common with the other students in his class. That's not to say that parents and professionals should stay away from talking about his disability. That makes no sense. That's a huge part of who he is and what he deals with on a day-to-day basis. But dealing with that in a matter-of-fact way, it's a fact of life. It's not an adjective. It's not a describer of who he is as a person. It's just a fact of his existence, hopefully could help him kind of take that next leap in feeling good about himself.
Merriam-Webster's, one of their top definitions of the many listings for normal is just occurring naturally. I would say Jake is occurring naturally. You're normal, man. You know, I mean, I just want him to feel you are natural, you are normal. Now, typicity, you know, is a different sort of term, and is that one that we are using more regularly, sort of neurotypical or typical versus normal? How do you view that difference?
I think that typical sounds a whole lot better than normal. I would like for us to be able to get to the point where we don't have to say typical either. For younger kids, one of the words that we use in teaching them social skills and social thinking is the concept of expected and unexpected, for example. So, you know, he did something that we did not expect for him to do. So instead of saying, that's weird, you just say, well, that was unexpected, and you move on. So giving kids the right words, different and expanded vocabulary to explain what they're going through, and to explain what they're seeing and experiencing, and opening it up so that it doesn't have such a negative connotation, even with what we would have considered up until very recently, handicapped parking places. We all still call them handicapped parking spots. What we should be calling them is accessible parking spots.
Okay. Mike, Aaron, want to add to that?
I think that we should lead off with what I can do rather than what I can't do. It goes so much further in someone's happiness and success. What I can do or not, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. And by the way, I really like accessible parking spot too. That's good. Aaron?
I think pointing out that these are your peers. They are your same age peers, and there might be differences. There's differences in all of us. We have, you know, some non-English speakers in our classroom, but they are still your peers. And kind of we started off, we say friends because we're young, we're in preschool, but that these are your friends and there's differences, but you're really all on the same playing field. It's just you're not playing exactly the same way.
All right. Anita in Rochester works with Rochester Accessible Adventures, and she's on the line. Go ahead, Anita. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much. This is a great show today. I'm enjoying listening to the very positive conversation about inclusive recreation. And I know one of your guests had said earlier that we're at a point where we've identified that this, you know, what it is that we want, which is that kids be able to recreate together and, you know, identifying what the next steps are. And I would love to partner with everybody there, because what we are doing and the reason RAA exists is to do just that. We have a model of assessment and training, and I think part of the factor is that sometimes we create really great trainings and then they sit on the table, they get pushed to the side of the desk because staff are very busy with their service implementation. But one of the things that RAA does is stay with them, and so we provide an inclusion specialist to help keep that going on an annual basis. So it actually becomes a part of the culture of the business. And I think that's really what I'm hearing today from the panelists, is that we're trying to change the whole culture and create inclusion as a true value. So I just wanted to put that out there. I'd love to continue the dialogue and work with folks as we further our mission and as we're changing businesses in our region right now and expand that. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Anita. I mean, Anita's putting it exactly how we didn't necessarily put it this way, but it's exactly how I think is appropriate, which is that this is partially a cultural change. It's a societal change. It's a change in expectation, and it's a change in what we expect for our children. So she's with Rochester Accessible Adventures. Let me ask all of our guests before we lose the hour to tell you about what they do. At CP Rochester, Erin Davis, tell us about what you do.
So CP Rochester, we run an integrated preschool program. We have classrooms that are make up of students with disabilities and then peers from the community. We're paired with Rush Henrietta's UPK program. So we offer that. We also have a variety of activities that go up. We have actually a rec program for older students. We have a bell program. We have a wraparound program for students. So we really start at preschool and go up with these kids. But I think the preschool is what I'm the most proud of, is that integrated piece and really seeing those friendships build and start. So,
very good. Mike.
At Epilepsy Prelude, we have a multitude of programs for individuals who have different types of disabilities, whether it be brain injury or neurological impairments like epilepsy, learning disabilities. We have day programs and things like that. At Epilepsy Specific, we have teen weekends. We have networking groups that parents can come together, or individuals who have epilepsy can come together and just lean on each other for climbing that mountain or getting over that barrier. Of course, I mentioned before about our camp, and Anita, the last caller, I definitely want to connect with you, because we just started an we call it Epi Rec, but it's Epilepsy Prelude Incorporated's recreation program, and it's for ages or individuals of all ages for epilepsy. But we have a lot of programs, not only for the individuals who suffer from the disorder, but their family members and friends too.
Okay, Rachel.
At Autism Up, we have a real broad variety of programs for people with autism and other neurodevelopmental disabilities, but our ultimate goal is not to keep them. Our ultimate goal is to give them those foundational skills that they need to be able to do those same things out in the community, in their neighborhood, at their Y, at their rec center, in their swimming pool. And we also offer training and support for organizations and schools to be able to enable their participants to do that.
All right. And we're going to have this cultural change that Anita talked about. And you got to do it in a short answer form. We're going to see more cultural change on this, more inclusion, if
people are willing to say yes.
Say yes. Okay. Mike?
We open our minds. We open our minds to what the potential could be and live the life of their choosing.
All right. Erin?
If we open our minds and say, why not?
All right. I want to thank all of our guests for being here. Erin Davis is a special education autism teacher at CP Rochester's Augustin Children's Center. Thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And by the way, online where, or people can get a hold of you where?
CPRochester.org.
Okay. Mike Riddell, education coordinator and camp director at Epilepsy Prelude, Inc. Where can people find you?
www.epiny.org.
All right, epiny.org. Thank you. Always nice having you. And
thank
Rachel Rosner, who is Director of Education and Support Services at Autism Up. Online where?
AutismUp.org.
Thank you. Thank you for taking time to be here again, Rachel. And that's another edition of Connections. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of Connections. And Megan Mack is the producer. Our thanks to Barsook Records for their approval of the use of this outstanding music. So if you hear that music every day and you know where it's from, thank Barsook Records and the band Ra Ra Riot. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk with you Wednesday on member-supported public radio.